Right on time, yeah. Five after is when I said, yeah?
Okay, good.
So, as I mentioned for this session, it'll just be one session, of course. We will go to mindfulness of breathing, but now add what is simply skillful means. But skillful means it's not necessarily skillful for everyone. So some people find the counting very, very helpful. And others find it simply clutters the attention. It's kind of an annoyance, kind of irritating or just cumbersome. So when it comes to this little adjunct, which is not indispensable at all, when it comes to this, then what I would suggest is that each of us just experiment for ourselves to see the extent to which it's helpful. Some may find for the whole session it's really helpful to count the breaths all the way through. Some may find maybe it's helpful to count 10 breaths and just not do it anymore. Or others may find that you count 10 breaths and then kind of happy to release the counting. And then 3 or 4, 5, 10 minutes later, you find the mind's wandering an awful lot. You said, okay, bring in the counting. Let's do 10 counts again, just to kind of bring it back. So whether you don't do it at all, whether you do it all the time or intermittently, it's entirely up to you. But I'll give a method that I found helpful. And so let's just jump right in. Mindfulness of breathing. Emphasis on this balance of stability without losing relaxation. And the counting is just to help subdue, to calm the compulsive flow of thinking. So please find a comfortable position. So let's spend just a bit of time beginning to look at these 9 stages. The source for this goes back to a Mahayana sutra, so teachings attributed to the Buddha in the Mahayana canon. You find a briefer account in the Pali canon. But then it's really quite highlighted in the Tibetan tradition. And among all the traditions, the one that I find that gives the most detailed and really, I would say, kind of scientific account of it, very detailed, very sophisticated, is the Gelugpa tradition, which again focuses on a developmental approach. And that's very much what is highlighted in these 9 stages. So we can go to page 2 of the notes. We'll just spend a short time doing this, just looking into just the beginning of it. 9 stages to attentional balance, and it is stated, and I think quite rightly, that whether you know about these stages or not, or whatever method you may be following, this is actually an organic development of attention. It's not a dogma or some kind of doctrine or something that should happen. But if your mind really does develop to the point that you achieve shamatha, and we'll discuss what that means later on, this is how it organically just develops. This is what does take place. And even though chopping it up to 9 phases is clearly putting a cookie cutter into the process, nevertheless, this is the course of the development, the maturation of attention skills. So it's a strong statement, it's an empirical statement. One could definitely put it to the test. So 9 stages that precede the actual achievement of shamatha. So let's just go ahead and look at the first one. We'll call it directed attention. And the format here is my own, with these, all of these bullet items and so forth, but the content is all traditional, and it's based not just on one text or one person, but it's more of a synthesis of generations and generations of yogis sharing their experiences of what it's like to have achieved shamatha, because thousands of people have done so. People continue to do so to this present day. So it's simply incorrect to say, oh, this is only good in the old times, but now nobody can do it anymore. Not true. But as we'll see, you do need to set up certain causing conditions to be able to really progress well in the practice. So, when you achieve the first out of nine stages, what is achieved is that you are able to direct your attention to the chosen object. In other words, you're able to find your target, right? So, the object that I've suggested, of course, the sensations of the breath, whether as they manifest throughout the body or now we see for this afternoon, a bit more targeted, the sensations of the rise and fall of the abdomen. If you are able to detect the sensations of the rise and fall of the abdomen as you breathe in and out, you got a lock, even if it's only for a second or two, welcome to having achieved stage one. You're already there. Okay? So this is one reason why I like to start with mindfulness of breathing, because it's pretty easy to find the object. Now, more difficult, of course, to sustain that focus, but at least to be able to find it and say, okay, I'm not bewildered here. I know when I'm off, and then I recognize, usually retrospectively, when I'm off, that it's kind of encouraging, that it's not daunting from the very beginning. I do know people who, when it comes to visualization, I've heard people say, I can't visualize at all. I mean, tell me I'm supposed to focus on a Buddha image or anything, and just nothing happens. It's, I think, a little bit rare, but I have found people that just say, I can't do it at all. In which case, if you say, okay, well, too bad for you, try harder, it might take them quite a long time, even to get to stage one, where if you say, focus on a Buddha image, you say, well, I got kind of a blurry yellowish fuzz. Does that count? You know, something there, kind of yellowish color of a Buddha. And so that could be more difficult, obviously. Focusing on a bindu at your heart, or a little orb of light at your heart. Some people can do that quite quickly, others might have a hard time. Or if you decide you'd like to come in and you'd like to develop shamatha on the body, speech, mind of Kala Chakra. That's 720 deities. So that might take a bit longer. Right? So, but we're starting just with the tactile sensations of the breath. So there it is, that's what you achieve. And the power by which you achieve it is learning the instructions. It's called the power of hearing. And that is whether you learn it from a book or you learn it from some teacher, from this person's mouth to your ear. But that's how you learn it. You hear the instructions, say, okay, I've understood it, and then you target it and you find it. So that's the method. You get the instructions. Now we'll see these bullet items. How many are there? There are 7 bullet items. That's going to go all the way through the 9 stages, which gives, I think, lends a certain coherence. Or then you can see the organic development as these gradually shift from one stage to the next. What problems persist once you've achieved the first stage, which means you're simply able to find your target? It didn't say at all how long you can sustain that focus. It just says that you are able to hit the target, right? So what problems persist? Well, and these all from classic sources, backed by an enormous amount of experience from generations of yogis. It says when you're first starting out on this practice, you essentially have no attentional continuity on the object at all. You just peck at it. You get to it, you get to the object, and then within a matter of, you know, 1, 2, 3 seconds, you're already off again. So it's not to say it's absolutely no continuity, but there's so little that we'd have to say, well, there wasn't any, right? Now, it's very easy. This is the value of learning about these 9 stages. It would be very easy at the beginning to say, oh, but I couldn't establish any continuity at all. I'm hopeless. I tried it, I couldn't do it. And I think I must be the worst person. I've had a number of my students say, I think I'm your worst student. Well, that's just because they don't know how bad all the other ones are. Right? But it's not to say they're all bad either. I mean, so it's just all relative. Why not say they're all equally good? And good is not very good. You know, relative to what? And so this is also a well-known truth in modern psychology, dating back more than 100 years. William James looked at this, that is drawing from various research done in the latter part of the 19th century. And they did studies back then, more than 100 years ago, of people being given a task where they're just asked to focus on some static image, like just an image of your home. Do you know what the front of your home looks like, or your car, or a spouse, or your child, any familiar object? But just bring it to mind. Okay, let's just do it now. It's going to be a five second little test. Familiar image of anything, bring it to mind. Try to hold it for 5 seconds. Okay, finished. 100 years ago, when they were checking this out, they found that people pretty well maxed out at 3 seconds. And that's as long as they could focus their attention on that. Now, in contrast, if you have a developing line of thought, maybe you've memorized a poem, can you sustain your attention on the poem from start to finish? If you've well memorized it, oh yeah, you can maintain your attention much longer than 3 seconds. Or so many other things where it's discursive thinking and you have some kind of a line of thought, then definitely yes. Or remembering a melody, one of the Beatles tunes. Oh, definitely, you don't lose your mind after 3 seconds. But when it comes to just attending to just plunking down on something that just sits there, 3 seconds and you're out, which suggests kind of basically no attentional continuity at all. And what William James and his colleagues found, and what yogis have found in India and Tibet for hundreds of years, this is normal, so don't get discouraged. And that's, again, why you learn about the first stage, that you may think, oh, I'm terrible, I suck, I'm awful. No, you're not. You're completely normal. So you say you're normal great, normal poor. Why don't I just say it's normal without, you know, giving it a positive or a negative valence to it? Now, there's a psychologist, very distinguished psychologist at Harvard right now named Steve Coslin. I've met him a number of times, and he's one of the world experts on mental imagery. That's what he studies. And so he has commonly Harvard undergraduates coming in as subjects in the study. He'll give them something to visualize and ask them to then manipulate the visualization, to navigate within the visualization and so forth. So it gets pretty sophisticated. And Harvard, I guess, keeps on coming up number one as American university, or maybe even internationally, I don't know, but very fine university. So you can assume the students are very bright. So how well can these very, very bright and perhaps highly motivated students, how long can they maintain a mental image? And Stephen Coslin has found 7 seconds is the best they do. So once again, that's not part of Harvard training to, you know, learn how to sustain your attention on anything, nor was it in high school or middle school or elementary school or preschool. So just to know, oh, okay, I really have a hard time maintaining any continuity. Good, par for the course. This is totally normal. But now, what type of attentional imbalances are really to characterize or are really dominant on this phase of attentional development? And here we go into a bit of technical terminology. It's easy to understand and it's very useful. So we call this coarse excitation. And I'm drawing on Genlam Rinpa's oral teachings because I was his intern, so to speak, for a one-year shamatha retreat I organized. I shudder at the thought, but it was 24 years ago that we had a one-year retreat. And he was the principal teacher. I was his assistant, his intern. He gave marvelous teachings, which are recorded in that book out there. I think it's called Call Me in the Mind. I think so. So he broke this down from a lot of oral teachings he'd received and then based upon excellent scholarship. But let's just go look at what coarse excitation is. You see this on the bottom of page 3. We're going to break excitation and laxity into coarse, medium, and subtle. So when you're experiencing what we will call coarse excitation, when that occurs, your attention completely disengages from your meditative object. You've forgotten about it entirely. Your attention is wholly elsewhere. Well, this is very common, and that is you completely lose your mind, completely lose the thread. You may outside look like you're meditating, and inside you're just going off on one excursion, your mind totally absorbed in something entirely different. So that's very, very prevalent, very dominant on stage one. And that more so than laxity or dullness or other kind of attentional imbalances. Coarse excitation for most people tends to be the most dominant one when you first set out. Geshe Ngaman Taige, the Lama from whom I first learned shamatha back in 1972, and as soon as I heard about it, I was quite enamored by it. I thought, oh, that's really important. And he made the comment that one of the first signs of progress when you're practicing shamatha, and he was a very accomplished meditator, actually spent the closing years and years of his life in New Zealand. Went to Dunedin and taught there. Marvelous, marvelous Lama. He mentioned that when you're practicing shamatha, one of the first indications that you're really getting somewhere, that you're doing it correctly, is noting, probably to your surprise or perhaps chagrin, how incredibly turbulent and agitated your mind is. That's the first thing. It's like, whoa, is it noisy in here? And as I recall, it's a long time ago, but as I recall now, it's what, 40 years ago, he gave an analogy, and it would be like if you're walking along a busy street, like downtown Manhattan, let's say, or any major street, and you're either you have headphones on and you're caught up in music, or you're just totally caught, lost in your thought, ruminating. But then you kind of wake up and you look around, and then suddenly as you kind of direct your attention to the environment, you say, whoa, it's noisy here. It's really, wow, there's so much traffic and people coming and going. Wow, this is really chaotic. And, you know, welcome to downtown any major city. And so it's a good analogy, because in our ordinary just course of life, our attention tends to be really riveted outwards. Other people, the environment, sensory input here, and this, that, and the other thing. We're thinking about this and hoping that and anticipating that and remembering that, but we tend to be very outwardly focused. And so we may then complain about, oh, my environment is so chaotic, my environment is noisy, it's loud, it's brass, it's very, very abrasive, very upsetting, and my mind's fine, but boy, my environment's really chaotic, right? But then if you take that, you just slip right, go directly from that environment and go off to a quiet room, like a solitary cell, close the door and it's soundproof, then you'll see, oh, compared to the environment, my mind is much, much noisier. Because now that you're not being caught up in and attentive to all the chaos of the environment, then you see, oh, it was chaos meeting chaos, but the outer chaos drowned out the inner chaos because that's where my attention was directed, right? Well, go off to your room for 20 minutes each morning or 24 minutes or what have you, where it's quiet, nobody's knocking on the door, no radio, no telephone, none of that. And then you say, whoa, this is downtown Manhattan, but Manhattan is my mind. So actually discover how turbulent your mind is the first sign of real progress. If you're not aware of that, you're probably still fixating elsewhere. So the type of mental engagement, how are you engaging with your meditative object, you have to get really focused. You have to pay attention. It doesn't happen, it doesn't just land in your lap. It's not effortless. So you really need to direct your attention, to focus your attention, and that's how you get the engagement. That does take some effort, and in that winding road depiction, that illustration, this is where the big flame comes in. You really say, okay, now I'm going to focus, and that requires some effort. But now, we go to these last two bullet items, the sixth and seventh. These two are taken from Mahamudra literature, which I'll mention right now, is focusing more on another method, the method of settling the mind in this natural state, or focusing on the mind and its contents, and that will start day after tomorrow. So I just want you to mention that these are metaphors that are given, or descriptions that are given, that pertain directly to that method, and not so much to mindfulness of breathing. It's a bit different. But they're here, just so you know that when we do get to the practice day after tomorrow, then you'll see how sensible this is. It turns out to be very correct. Either way, right now it doesn't matter. We haven't hit that fork in the road of the real difference between the effects of mindfulness of breathing versus settling the mind in its natural state. But as you're attending to the breath, and of course you're not only practicing mindfulness, but from the very beginning you should be practicing introspection as well. So you're noting how turbulent, how lax, how dull, how sleepy your mind is, that as you start focusing there on this very simple task, like mindfulness of breathing, what's the feel of it? What's your sense if you gave it just one noun to describe, or just one word, describe, okay, what was it like? And for generations of Tibetan yogis, they say, well, when I did that, what I had the sense of was movement. A lot was happening. Okay. Thoughts peppering in, I'm hitting sounds, I'm getting emotions and images and memories and imaginations and hopes and fears and just so much stuff happening in the midst of trying to do something very simple, and that is just get a lock on your meditative object and then hold on. So sensation of movement, of activity, of agitation, one could say. And then here he'll give a whole series. This is from Lama Mipam Rinpoche, one of the great Nyingma Lamas of the 19th century. He gave this series of metaphors, the seventh bullet item, and that is, how would you characterize the flow of rumination or involuntary thought? If you gave it an analogy, what's it like? And he said, okay, in this first stage, and this is all utterly experiential, this not trying to abide according to some doctrine. The analogy he gave was, it's the flow of involuntary thought is like a cascading waterfall. This is one where you have a strong current of a river, and it just shoots over the lip of some cliff, and it's just spraying all over the place, lots of volume, but very chaotic, just tumbling water. So we've all seen it. You don't need much of a description. But that's the impression, that the thoughts is like a geyser, like we nowadays maybe like a fire hydrant, of just thoughts tumbling over each other, one after another after another. So a lot of people find that is just the sheer quantity of thoughts can be quite overwhelming. And so welcome to Shamatha land. This is what it's like to get into it. And it's what I find very helpful here is that if one didn't know that this is other people's experience, you might think that you're a real aberration or you're backward or incapable or just not the kind of person who could ever achieve shamatha because you have all these characteristics. And what he's saying here, hey, this is completely normal. This isn't good, bad. This is just how most people are. And having said that, of course there's still variations. Some people come early on and they find dullness is a big factor. Not everybody, but some people do. And some people are very gifted. And some people are gifted for mathematics, music, and so forth. Some people are very gifted for shamatha. They slip into it, and really the quality is considerably better than that, even in the beginning, because they're coming in with kind of a gift, a talent. And so it's not the same for everybody, but overall, these are very good generalizations. And if you find that these descriptions tally pretty closely to your experiences last night or today, then consider, good, you're on the right track. And if you're able to follow the object, then you've achieved stage one. Congratulations. Then let's just do one more, and then we'll call it an afternoon. If you persist in the practice, maintaining some regular practice, it's not coming in big spurts of trying to do 3 or 4 hours and then not doing it for a couple of weeks and then getting aroused and doing it a few hours. That's not going to give rise to much of transformation at all. But if you're maintaining a regular practice, persistent, persevering, then over the course of time, and I have to leave that very vague, then you'll achieve the second stage if you're practicing effectively, intelligently, good motivation. And so what are the characteristics of this second one, continuous attention? What is achieved now is attentional continuity on the chosen object for up to a minute, which is to say that for up to a minute, not a whole bunch of minutes all in a row, but for a minute occasionally here and there, for as long as a minute, you'll have that sense of a brief duration of flow during which, it's not to say that you're maintaining impeccable samadhi, it is to say that for up to a minute at a time, you're not completely forgetting the object. In other words, you're free, for up to a minute, free of coarse excitation. So thoughts may be buzzing around, and you'll be hearing things and experiencing your body and so forth and so on, but that sense that you're never completely disengaged. So if you are a horse rider in a rodeo, and a lot of your body may be up in the air when the horse is really bucking, or maybe it's a bull, you're bull riding. So you may be mostly up in the air, but if you're still holding on, if you still have, you know, you have one hand on the handle, on the saddle, I should say, one hand on the saddle, then you say, okay, you're still on the critter. It hasn't bucked you off, because you've not entered into coarse excitation. You haven't completely forgotten the bull or the horse, the bucking bronco, whatever it may be. You're still connected to it. Even though you're gyrating all over the place and there's a lot of agitation and so forth, you've not been bucked off. If you're in the dirt, then that's coarse excitation. Or if you're in midair and no part of you is touching any part of the bull, the chances of coming back on the bull are pretty small, because it doesn't want you on its back. Okay? So, for up to a minute. Now, where does the minute come from when you would consider that for almost all of Buddhist history, until the very recent past, Buddhist meditators did not have clocks, let alone ones with a second hand. So where does 1 minute come from? Well, they had rosaries and they had Om Mani Padme Hum. And so what I'm calling a minute is, if you've got a pretty quick tongue, Om Mani Padme Hum once around the rosary, 108 times. It's more or less a minute. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. You can count it. So once around the rosary, about that long, If on occasion, in let's say a 24-minute session, and this is a classic duration, this goes back about 1,000 years to, as I recall, Kamala Shila, when he was asked, great Indian meditator who taught in Tibet, how long should the sessions be at the beginning? Well, not too long, not too short, not so long that they drag on, you're getting bored and sloppy, not so short that you can't ever get into the continuity, the flow of the practice. So they found once, and then where does 24 minutes come from, with no wristwatches, 1/60th of a 24-hour period. And that you can do with a water clock and so forth. And so, and I found, that's why I teach it, 24 minutes, not as long as a half an hour, but not so short, you really can't get into it. 24 minutes, you really shouldn't be experiencing physical distress. If you are, then switch postures, you know, so you don't have that nagging on you. So, in a 24-minute period, here and there, finding you're maintaining continuity for 20 seconds. Oh, there for only 5 seconds. Oh, there for 40 seconds. Oh, there we got it, 60 seconds. There for 70 seconds. Oh, there for 3 seconds. And so, but you'll get these moments of kind of continuous sanity where you don't completely lose your mind for up to a minute. So that's what's called continuity. A relatively crude level, and just for those minutes, for those periods up to a minute, you're free of coarse excitation. And how do you achieve that? This, the power by which you achieve the second stage, it's called the power of thinking. The power of thinking. So this can be understood in two different ways. You receive the instruction, maybe you read the instruction or a combination of the two. And then when you're not doing the practice, you reflect upon it. You think about it. Now, okay, what was introspection? How is that different from mindfulness? What were the definitions? What was the object? And then when was I supposed to arouse? When to relax? And what were the three qualities? Relaxation, what was that second? Stability, and then and there was something. Oh yeah, vividness. And what was the sequence? And, you know, it's just basically going through it until you're getting familiar with it. You're making it more come and you actually know it. But it's right there on your fingertips, so to speak. And in terms of technique, the theory, the definitions, the mental faculties involved, the significance of it. So by reflecting on it, this gives greater understanding of the practice, but perhaps also some inspiration, some interest, some motivation. Oh, well, that must be really good, you know? That must be worth doing, regardless of whether you want to achieve liberation, if you want to even get an education or hold a coherent conversation. These attention skills can be very useful. So on the one hand, thinking about the theory, the practice, the techniques in between sessions, that's one way to develop enough inspiration, motivation, determination, will to get on with it and actually get somewhere in the practice. But there's another way of interpreting this as well. It comes up a lot in question and answer periods. And that is during the session. There you are focusing on the breath. And I've been asked many, many times now, is it okay to have a bit of a commentary going on? Like, whoops, hey, you just got distracted. Okay. Oh, getting a bit dull. Oh, good, now you're doing it right. Good, carry on. Okay. Now you got distracted again. Oh. A bit of commentary, like a sportscaster, you know. Is it okay that, or is that just no, mustn't do it at all? And to an extent, in the early phases of the practice, when you're not all that familiar with it yet, to have these internal reminders, oh, now this is introspection, oh, my mind just got distracted with, oh, I remember, okay, relax, what was that? Relax, release, return, got it, okay, I'm going to do that right now. Keep on reminding yourself within the practice, that commentary, being your own mentor, mentoring yourself through to keep on refreshing your memory, learning how to focus, what to focus on, how to recognize the imbalances, how to remedy the imbalances. So you have your internal coach, so to speak, which will be giving you guidance. Of course, it's you giving guidance to yourself, using some internal commentary that could be useful. And for that matter, even counting the breaths is thinking. So that too is a type of internal coaching, right? Like in the in those, I always forget the name, but those boats that the Oxford and Cambridge, they have the, you know, the, what are they called? The very thin ones on the river. You all know. The rowing boats, you know. And they have one person, while most of the guys are really pulling and pulling and trying to scoot, cut through the water, there's one person there who's hopefully pretty lightweight because his only job is just to keep the beat, right? You've all seen it. And so, but apparently, they feel it's, even though he's taking up, you know, putting some great more weight in the boat, nevertheless, having that guy there to keep the beat, he has nothing else to do than just keep the beat, that they figure it's worthwhile. And that's why he's there. Well, that beat, then he's doing counting. I mean, he is doing for these, the oarsmen, what the counting is doing to do meditative practice, just keeping the beat, keeping the rhythm. And so that also is the power of counting, counting the breaths. So that's the second way. So moving right on, what problems persist? Out of your 24-minute session, most of the time you're off the object. And you do have continuity up to a minute, but you're still, if you just look, am I on or off? Most of the time you're still off. And it's so helpful to know that. Don't get discouraged. It's really easy to get discouraged in this practice. Early on, think, I can't do it. I know what I should be doing. I can't do it. Therefore, I better stop because I'm not getting anywhere. So no, you are doing it. And yeah, quite right. You're most of the time off the object. Don't get discouraged. This is normal. And this is written in, 500 years ago in Tibet. As in the earlier stage, the primary problem for most people in this stage is coarse excitation. So no further explanation needed. The type of mental engagement, how you're really engaging with the meditative object, still, you really need to focus. You really need to do something. Focus. And still, now no change here. If you're practicing this practice, will start day after tomorrow. Still, a lot of thoughts coming up. A lot of activity of the mind, movement of the mind, images, thoughts, and so forth. And in this practice, settling the mind, the same metaphor is given. Still, the flow of thoughts is pretty much unabated. Just like a cascading waterfall. So lots of activity, but in the midst of all of that, you are developing some real continuity. Much more so, significantly more so, than you had when you are still on stage one. Okay? So you can see that the primary difference is there. Some things the same, but then here you can understand it intellectually, conceptually, but then when you get on the cushion, then you can see, there was a minute. I think that must have been at least a minute or so. I was on. Maybe I'm... And by the way, we'll end on this note, because it's now after five. How you progress through these stages is, as I said yesterday, I think, it's not linear. It's not just like, okay, I'm better today, and I'm better, and I'm still better, and oh, good, this is going so smoothly. It's really choppy. So if from your left to your right, it's like this. But you are going, but statistically, I mean, if you average that out, it would be nice and linear. But you'll have really bad days, you'll have really good days. And when you're fairly early on in the practice, you may have a session or two where you feel, boy, that was a two. Time and time again, boy, I was in that flow. I could maintain it for a minute, minute and a half. And then the next day you feel like I've never meditated in my life. Like whatever happened to yesterday? And then you start singing a Beatles song, And so what you'll have is kind of a flirtation with, or an introduction to, almost like seeing a trailer of a movie. You'll get these sneak previews on stages two, but then you'll be back on one for a while. And then you'll get two, 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 and then one, one. And then two, 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 one, one. And then, so gradually you'll be shifting back, like to and froing, and then one, one, and three, and then back to two, and then one. And then more threes coming in. So that's how it tends to be. And then once in a while you really spike up, you have a fantastic session. Say, oh, good, I've achieved stage five. And the next day you're back on two again, But it's not just bumbling all over the place like a drunk stumbling around, bumping into things. It's not just chaotic, and it's not linear like troops marching down a road. It's neither one, right? So if you know that from the beginning, this again can save time. And we really have to cherish confidence, because confidence is so easily lost in this practice. People swiftly come to the conclusion, I've been meditating for 2 months, and that session, I'm not getting anywhere. I'm like, you had a bad day. Get over it. That's part of the practice. So if you know that from the beginning, and there's a lot more to be said about this, but not right now, that the evolution, the development, the maturation is not smooth, it's choppy, it's forward and backward, but as you mature in the practice from a deeper level, and it always keeps on coming back to relaxation, you can get these spurts ahead by really getting impatient. And say, that last session really sucked. I'm going to just try harder. And then you do, and it's better. But it's fake. It's like fool's gold. It's better, just because you're clamping down so hard. But you won't be able to maintain it. And it's not to say no effort. It's saying that's too much. But it will seduce you if you try really hard. You get so impatient, so frustrated. I'm going to just go for it this time. Chances are you may. You may have much better attention durability or continuity in that session. It's going to tap you out. Try that for 5 or 6, 10, 20 sessions. You'll be burnt. So then just keep on, and this is what, and I have students I've been training now for years, and some of my still keep on coming back. Say, go deeper into relaxation. Go deeper. They've heard me say it, and it's so easy to forget. Because we get impatient. We start getting filled with desire and maybe frustration and impatience. And, I should be. I'm not, how many times have I heard this? I'm not progressing as fast as I expected. When I went in for my first retreat with His Holiness, and the first time we sat down and He was giving personal guidance, we spoke back and forth Tibetan English, kind of chop-chop. Sometimes English, sometimes Tibetan. But He just came out of the blue and said, in English, to me, in the first session that He was guiding me in my shamatha practice, He said, and I quote Him, expectation is the foundation of failure. He wanted to make sure I got it. I'm saying in your language, Buster. Don't forget this one. And I have not, and I've passed that on many, many times. Expectation is just a trap. Release it all. Have the aspiration. Learn how to do the practice. When you're doing the practice, just do it. But all expectations, expecting to do poorly and expecting to do well, either way, you're slapped from the left, you're slapped from the right, but you're just still slapped. And it's just not useful. It's just not useful. So, just do the practice. And crucially, I'll end on this point, here's a really crucial element, and that is when you're doing the practice correctly, and I mean for 2 seconds at a time, you're there, you know how to do it, and now very crucially, these words are very important, you're doing it correctly, in this moment, right now, and you know you're doing it correctly. Those are two different things. You can do it correctly and not know it, or not be aware of it, just doing it, but doing it correctly, and knowing you're doing it correctly, for 2 seconds at a time, and 5 seconds at a time, that's where you really get someplace. And take satisfaction in that moment of doing it correctly and knowing you're doing it correctly. And in Tibetan, they say, shine dupa. Now you're accomplishing shamatha. That's accomplishing shamatha. Doing it correctly for 1 second and 3 seconds, right there in the moment, no anticipation, no expectation. When are we there yet? Have I achieved this yet? All that stuff, all that congestion, all that junk that we throw into the process. Keep the junk out. And when you're doing it correctly, know you're doing it correctly and take satisfaction in that. That's where you achieve shamatha. Do it correctly, know you're doing it correctly, and take satisfaction in doing it. It's really that simple. And start messing it up with other stuff, and that's where you get all kinds of unnecessary problems. Okay? So, let's take a break. It's now, let's 10 after 5, and I'd like to give us two full hours. So let's do come back. Now this is called prospective memory, remembering something in the future. Let's come back at 10 minutes past 7, give ourselves a full 2-hour break. And my hope and expectation, I'm going to fall into that pitfall, is that you will continue breathing for the next 2 hours. Which means unlike a practice where I say generate a Buddha image or do something that, you know, generate something that wasn't there, that breathing is carrying on whether you're attending to it or not. But that means moment by moment, breath by breath, it's your whole body-mind system is dishing up the meditative object. Like, would you like to practice shamatha? Would you like to practice shamatha? Would you like to practice shamatha? And if you're just caught up in rumination, the answer is no thank you, no thank you, no thank you. You know? And that's how you backslide. So you can go forward in meditation, and then if you just go back into the old ruts of rumination, wandering mind, just letting the mind of your, you know, your attention like a dog off the leash and just running all over the place, then when you get back to the cushion, then you have to repair all the damage. You have to kind of, you know, sober up. Whereas in between sessions, now I see the sun is shining, and I'm sure it's very beautiful outside. Go outside, refresh, take a walk, enjoy the sunlight, the birds, extraordinary birds you have here, the gentleness of this immediate environment. So enjoy it, but with your peripheral awareness, if you really are resting in that present moment, not caught up in rumination, and maintaining just a peripheral awareness of the in and out breath, that sustains the continuity in between sessions. You get the refreshment you need, because we can't always be, you know, meditating 24 hours a day. You get that kind of spaciousness, the relaxation, the refreshment, have your meal, all of that. But as much as you can, just in a very light way, like with your pinky, just keep the finger on the pulse of the in-breath, the out-breath, keep grounded in the present moment. And then when you come back to your next session, it'll be a much smoother transition in. And the overall development of attention skills will be much more effective. Okay? So now it is 10 past 5, so let's come back in 2 hours exactly. See you then, and enjoy your dinner.